You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us this morning Mike Ferner and Jane Ann Morris, who are both with POCLAD, which is the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And they are in town for part of the Defying Corporations and Defining Democracy Tour. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Good morning.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Let me start out with the obvious and ask you to tell us, what exactly is POCLAD?
POCLAD stands for the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And it was formed about in 1983-84 and sort of grew to including now about a dozen people. And I think it's defining purpose is sort of that we wanted to look for ways to have our activism be more effective. And we found that though there was a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of work being done, that we weren't getting where we needed to go as fast as we need to get there.
Okay, and just by the name alone, obviously your focus is on corporations. You see some problem with corporations?
Well, as we began to look at why our activism was less effective than we'd like it to be, what was stopping us? What are the obstacles that were preventing all these well-informed, well-meaning people from getting more things done? We found that more and more they were corporate obstacles, and now we understand that a lot of them have to do with the specific powers that corporations have been granted, and in fact, the fact that judicial orders over the years have claimed that corporations have constitutional rights themselves.
Okay, now give us some history on this then. Have corporations in their current form, have they always had this power, or has this evolved over time?
Well, let me just give one quick example and then let Mike jump in here. But a couple of years ago, a community in Cape Cod made some zoning decisions about cell towers in their area. And this was not pleasing to the lawyers at a telecommunications corporation. And the corporation sued that community under the 1964 Civil Rights Bill for damages for making a decision about protecting the health of their community. That was only possible because over 100 years ago, in a series of cases in the United States Supreme Court, the corporation itself, the fictional entity, was recognized as having equal protection and due process rights.
So that's one of the things that we've seen that has prevented activists from being more effective and prevented communities from being able to make their own decisions on the sorts of things that they think are good for their communities. The Commerce Clause, Jane Ann mentioned the 14th Amendment, which is due process and equal protection, was granted to corporations. That was in 1886. In a Supreme Court decision. The Commerce Clause, which has been in the Constitution since it was written, is something that prevents communities all across the country from... I'll give you an example. If a community wants to keep out a Walmart store, for example, and there is a developer that's got a parcel of land, and if that land is already zoned appropriately, it's zoned, you know, commercial retail, let's say, and there are no other zoning changes that need to be made. They don't have to bring in another parcel of land or anything. There is no way legally that a community can say, we just don't want a Walmart in here. Because if it's zoned correctly and the developer wants to bring a Walmart in, then that's it. If the community were to pass some ordinance that said, we don't want a Walmart in here, The company attorneys would probably win by going to federal court and claiming that the local ordinance was unconstitutional. It violated the Commerce Clause, which prevents interference in interstate commerce. So the only way now, given this example, the only way now that local communities have any control over something as important as the kind of these big box operations that come in and strip out a small downtown, for example, we've seen this happen over and over. The only way that a local community has any control is if there's some little zoning angle that they can work. If the developer needs to get another parcel brought in or change the zoning that's already there, the community can say, oh, we're not going to change the zoning. But that is it. And so this is just another example of all the kinds of things that over time corporations have built up this enormous body of privileges or rights, as they call them, and it really puts a hammer on local communities.
So how is it that the Commerce Clause came into being? What was the conditions then?
Okay, the Commerce Clause in the beginning of the United States was used for very limited things. It basically says that the U.S. Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce or commerce among the states. And in the beginning, in order to qualify as being covered by that clause, you had to carry stuff across a state line to sell it. Now it's expanded vastly, and to the point where an Ohio chicken farmer growing wheat for his own chickens, he thought he could do that without interfering with any federal policies, was found to be included. That's a famous 1942 case. So the point is that now that almost anything that can be construed by the Supreme Court or federal courts to somehow affect interstate commerce can be something that the Supreme Court can claim states cannot pass laws about. I'll give you an example everyone can relate to, and that is Alabama has the largest commercial hazardous waste facility in the nation, and they figured out over the last couple decades that they do not want to become the toxic hazardous waste dump for the whole nation, and in fact with the World Trade Organization agreements now, perhaps for the world. And they passed a number of laws, and they're not the only state, but there's a standout, trying to find ways of limiting hazardous waste coming in from out of state, so that they would not become the dump for the whole nation. And several of those were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court on Commerce Clause grounds. But this Commerce Clause isn't the only one. Another example that I think people can relate to is in the workplace. Most people, when they go to work, if they work at a private corporation, they park most of their constitutional rights at the door. They're vastly restricted in their ability to organize, to talk, to pursue what we would call due process while they're at work or in matters concerning work. On the other hand, the corporation they're working for has constitutional rights, equal protection, due process, significant protection against searches and seizures, First Amendment free speech rights, and others.
So, for example, if you're working in a workplace where, as most workplaces are, there's hazardous material, occupational dangers of one sort or another, the company can actually, under the Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure, the company can require OSHA inspectors, health and safety inspectors, to produce the equivalent of a warrant, so that they've got this protection against unreasonable search and seizures, which, when the Fourth Amendment was written, was meant to protect individuals. But because corporations over time have gotten most of the same rights as human beings, they can invoke this particular right. So, as Jane Ann was saying, the individual human being, the flesh and blood person that goes to work there, leaves their First Amendment rights at the door. They have no First Amendment rights on company property. They have no virtually no Fourth Amendment rights. If you have a worker has a locker, there's the worker can claim no right to having any unreasonable search and seizure protections. So it goes on and on. Things have really been stood on their head. And the corporations have come out with even more rights than human beings have. And this is, I mean, it wasn't an accident, the way the whole thing was set up. The fact that the Constitutional Convention didn't rewrite the Articles of Confederation, threw them all out, and in Philadelphia, when that was written in 1787, the deliberations were kept secret. The notes of the Constitutional Convention didn't come out until 50-some years later. It was really rammed down people's throats back home to get the required number of states to pass it. You know, the all sorts of demons were produced that were going to happen to the population if this Constitution weren't passed. And it called for such a strong federal government and such a strong judiciary, an unelected federal judiciary in life terms, that the democratic levers of power were greatly reduced. The debates around this between the Federalists who wanted that form of government and the Anti-Federalists who were afraid of reestablishing a monarchy under another name, those debates raged back and forth. And we've some of the work that we've done is to try to bring out some of the information that people were concerned about at the time, because a lot of the problems that we're seeing today go back to the fact that when the country was founded, it was founded to protect privilege, to protect property rights over human rights.
And it sounds like that information has been missing from the history books. Is that right?
Well, it's been missing from a lot of them. Even some of the books that stress, for example, the role of women or Native Americans or workers and so on, don't always talk about exactly the way in which this legal fiction, the corporation, has managed to have a big pocket load of so-called rights and privileges and powers now. And what Mike was talking about in the examples we've both been bringing up are, in fact, why we're in Seattle now to promote this book. Because over the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've learned a lot. And most of us were good little activists before then and thought we knew a lot about our history. But we've learned a lot about the history of constitutional rights for corporations and increased corporate powers has been used very specifically to sort of displace a lot of the human rights of human persons. And so the book is a collection of things we've written over that time on a wide variety of things. There's a lot on labor in it. There's examples referring to regulatory agencies. There's things about the history of corporations' power as it was fought out in the very first years of the Republic. And there's specific examples responding to things that are now in the news, things like Social Security, a new wave of corporate social responsibility, and so on. So it's really a pretty broad collection spanning about 7 or 8 years of the kind of things we've been learning that we think are very important for activists to sort of talk over and then begin to apply.
One of my favorite pieces in here, actually, and I'm not just saying that because Jean Ann is here this morning, but the title alone is pretty catchy. It's the first essay in here. It's entitled "Help. I've been colonized and I can't get up. Take a lawyer and an expert to a hearing and call me in a decade." And that's the approach, you know, that you mentioned, that, you know, most of us were good little activists for a long time. You know, we come from a variety of movements and have beat our head up against the wall for quite a long time. And it's been an evolutionary process of finding out that the regulatory laws that we're faced with, that citizens are kind of channeled into this little narrow forum of regulatory laws to fight out these battles against corporations, and they're stacked decks. Most of the regulations were put in place with the support of the industries that were supposed to be regulated, because these were ways of channeling citizens' energy and putting a barrier between elected officials and the public. They could say, well, go talk to the Public Utilities Commission, or go talk to the regulatory, the EPA or whatever. And it's been a learning process to understand that we need to be battling corporate harms and the corporatization of our culture on a lot more fundamental level than going to regulatory hearings. Those are important to do, but we have to find out ways of doing more than that.
Let me give a couple quick examples of that. I agree completely. Just ideas that we would like to see discussed more and think are pretty important. For example, there are a lot of things going on now where people or groups of humans are negotiating with a corporation. And we would raise the whole question of, why are we negotiating with a corporation? First of all, it's impossible. It's a legal fiction. Secondly, democracy is about people talking with each other, all the people in a community, about what should happen. And I'm totally in favor of that. But to have the fictive corporate entity to be a party to negotiations, I think, is inappropriate to begin with. So that's one comment. Another quick one is that a lot of people now think it's a good idea if we've been able to put huge fines on corporations and, wow, we're really getting them or something like that. Well, I would like them to start considering, where's that money come from? There are only so many places. It does not come from the private pockets of the managers who made the policies that caused the problem that led to a fine. It comes either from pay that should have gone to workers, or safety measures that should have gone to protect the workplace or the community, or from higher prices to consumers, or from things that should have been paid in taxes or weren't, or an indirect cost on future generations through health costs and other problems. So, you know, the way things are set up now, it first sounds like we've really accomplished something when a large fine has been placed on a corporation, but I think, you know, we're still paying it. So those are the kind of fundamental questions that I think Mike is referring to.
You mentioned the regulatory agencies being compromised. How could that happen?
Well, I'll give you an example of, again, you know, Jane Ann mentioned that we come from an activist background, those of us that make up POCLAD. A lot of my work had been in the fighting nuclear power plants and fighting utility companies and rate increases and power lines and that sort of thing in Ohio, where I'm from. And it was quite a revelation to me to realize that the reason that in Ohio we have what's called the Public Utilities Commission, and there's a similar regulatory agency in every state, the reason that we have those regulatory agencies was because Samuel Insull, who was Thomas Edison's secretary, got the idea in the early part of the 1900s that if the industry itself didn't get behind what they at that time called scientific regulation, that the wave of public power, the public power movement that was taking over electric companies in town after town across the country, that the privately held electric industry would if not disappear, be significantly reduced, because people in communities across the country were so tired of getting ripped off by utility companies, by electric companies, that they were using their authority to create publicly owned electric systems and provide the same services, if not better, at a considerably lower price without lining the pockets of these utility executives. And so Sam Insull went around to state after state after state and talked to the industry groups in those states and said, listen, boys, we've got to go to our state legislatures and get them to pass this, some kind of a scientific regulation scheme, and Ohio will call it the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, and then we can tell people, oh, this is taken care of. If you've got a problem with the utility company, with your electric company, you take it to the Public Utilities Commission. We don't. We have this regulation now. The beast has been tamed, and it's not necessary to go to the extreme, let's say, of having a public power system. And in here for years, activists like myself have been going to the Public Utilities Commission to try to get some degree of justice when it came to the practices of the utility companies, to say nothing of building nuclear power plants. And then come to realize that the only reason that we get channeled into this dead end of the PUCO is because the industry realized that they had to set this whole scheme up in order to save their hides. So this is in the Interstate Commerce Commission that was set up in the 1887. Was significantly at the behest of the railroad interests. I mean, so the history is a long one of industry seeking this kind of regulation to prevent public indignation and democratic power from just plain taking them over. I mean, people wanted to nationalize the railroads during the populist era. The reaction was, well, let's get regulation, let's regulate the railroads.
Yeah, this is it's a significant part of what POCLAD ends up doing, is talking to people about regulatory agencies. We have all done long time in regulatory agencies, and we come from a perspective that thought that was the answer. And so we do have, you know, fairly extensive critiques of them, some specific, like the example Mike just brought about, some more generic. But that is part of what we talk about, but not from the point of view of people who grumble about too much government regulation and red tape, but from the point of view of people who really wanted them to work, who spent years and years and years learning all the ifs, ands, and buts in there, and then just found that, you know, hey, we're getting almost nowhere. We have no time to do anything else. And meanwhile, they're doing what they wanted to begin with. So since Mike brought up that regulatory thing, I wanted to mention that and say that there's quite a few things actually in the book that respond to regulatory concerns in one way or another, because that is the supposed good idea out there that many people think we should put our effort into. But just to give you a really quick summary of some of the ways in which regulatory agencies are, if not anti-democratic, certainly undemocratic, I just jotted a couple down. I just want to mention them. And anyone who has done time in them, long hours, and you know, those of you, I'm sure many of your listeners have, know exactly what I mean, will recognize these. One of the characteristics is you get obsessed with procedure, so that in fact questions of like, well, should we have a dump there, or what about the water, they get almost lost, and people know the minutiae of procedure that just leads us off from the fundamental questions we want to deal with. Secondly, it's very costly in money and resources to deal with regulatory agencies, and that inevitably means that large corporations with a lot of funds and big big stables of lawyers can last longer than we can. So it's very costly. It always disadvantages either a small business or a public group. A third characteristic is, as many people know and has been noted by analysts of regulatory agencies for decades and decades, they come to mirror the industry they're supposed to regulate. Who's there, the people at work there, the ideas they have. Fourth, regulatory agencies have incredible discretion. There are only 19 of these. No, there are only five. They have incredible discretion in that almost anything that you think was a law, don't do this, you can't have more than this. There are exemptions, variances, all kinds of wiggle room. And five, and the final point I'll make here about this, is that regulatory agencies combine the three branches of government. They essentially legislate by making regulations. They essentially are a judicial branch also because they get to judge them. And then also they have enforcement roles. So, in fact, no wonder we can't get anywhere with them. They sit there with these three hats that they can put on any time they want, and they have incredible discretion. So they're just like fundamentally, from the beginning, anti-democratic institutions.
There's a group that we're working with. Excuse me, in southern Pennsylvania. It's called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and they are concerned, as a growing number of rural organizations are, with these enormous corporate farms, hog factories in their case, in southern Pennsylvania. Something could be chicken farms or, you know, cattle farms, whatever. In southern Pennsylvania, in the several townships, they're concerned with these huge hog farms. Now, the typical approach, what Jane Ann was talking about, the regulatory agencies, the typical approach would be, well, the state EPA says that you can have three hogs per square foot, and maybe we ought to argue that you can only have 2.8 hogs per square foot. And if we really are successful, we'll get them down to 2.5 hogs per square foot or whatever the regulation is. These folks in this organization have been working with POCLAD and have developed a different approach that we think bears some hope. And that is that they did the long and tedious organizing with the rural residents, with the farmers, and with their local township elected officials. And they went through some of this history that we're talking about here, how corporations got the power that they have and why we shouldn't allow ourselves to get jammed into this little regulatory arena. And what they've come up with, among other strategies, one of the things that they've come up with is to have their township supervisors pass ordinances against corporate ownership of farms so that they don't argue on how many hogs per square foot. They say, we don't want them. We're not going to allow this kind of farming in our area. So now eight townships have passed those. The industry, of course, has gone berserk, and they've said they've hired attorneys who have ruled, in their opinion, that these ordinances are unconstitutional, and they're going to take them to court and, under the Commerce Clause, get them ruled unconstitutional. Well, now we've got a different dynamic, because here the education and organizing has been done so that it's not citizens going into a regulatory hearing. It's citizens plus their local elected officials saying, we want to have something to say about the kind of life that we want in this township. You know, we're gonna base this fight on fundamental rights to determine our lives, and not on some arcane regulations about how many hogs per square foot. And this is a whole nother battleground. And the corporations and government officials that are listening are aware that this is something very new and fundamentally different, because it's now a fight over who's in charge and who's going to make these very basic important decisions.
Yes, this reflects a two-pronged approach, which will work in a lot of cases just other than hog farms, because on the one hand, people organize and their local community moves to do what a self-governing people would do, whether it's banning corporate hog farms, whatever. And then the second prong of it is being ready to address the predictable constitutional objections that corporate lawyers are going to bring up. The Commerce Clause is a common one. Also, due process and equal protection. There's like a small handful of them. But be ready in your organizing and in your arguments to address not only the hog farm or the toxic waste dump or the Walmart or whatever, but also the constitutional aspects of it. And then, as Mike said, the whole dynamic changes. You're having a much broader discussion, and it involves acting a lot more like self-governing people and a lot less like blubbering supplicants in the regulatory agencies.
And just imagine for a second what a different world we would have, what a different society we would have if we were truly a self-governing people. You can take a number of examples. Healthcare. Would we have the kind of health care system in this country that we've got today if we were self-governing people, if the Aetna corporations of this country didn't have First Amendment rights to be involved in writing policy and buying policy and all of the things that corporations do? Would we have this kind of health care system? I really doubt it. Would we have this kind of transportation policy in this country that's just completely insane if General Motors Corporation wasn't, in fact, writing our corporation, writing our transportation policies? I mean, you can go back to the 30s, and it's been shown where General Motors Corporation, Standard Oil, Firestone Rubber Company, they got together and they formed this front group called National City Lines, and they went around buying up streetcar companies in city after city and ripping up the tracks and stacking up the cars and setting them afire. I mean, there's footage of this stuff available you can see. Well, how did this come to pass? Well, because General Motors Corporation got First Amendment rights, and they're in there making the kind of policy that we have to live with. What's that mean for us now in other parts of the world? I mean, why are we so concerned about keeping, quote, our oil in the Persian Gulf flowing? Because we use, you know, so much more energy than we need because it's the kind of energy policy and transportation policy that we've got courtesy of the corporations as opposed to what we would come up with as a self-governing people.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left, and I want to spend some time telling people that you're in town for several speaking engagements, because this half hour is is not nearly enough to convey all the great ideas you guys have. So do you want to tell us about some of the things you're going to be doing here in the next couple days?
Well, I'll tell you, tomorrow, Sunday, we're going to be doing a book signing and some brief talk and discussion period at Elliott Bay Books at First and Main, and that'll be at 1 p.m.
And then on Monday, we're going to have a public forum at the University of Washington at Gowen Hall, mm-hmm. room 301, and that's going to be at 7 p.m. on Monday, the 8th. And we're going to be on the public access TV Tuesday evening from 7 to 7:30, Network X on public access TV.
And then we're going to have another public forum, noon to 1 p.m. on Wednesday the 10th, and that will be at the Seattle University School of Law in the Sullivan Hall Room C5. And I know you know what that means. But also, if you're interested in some of this stuff and want to learn more about us, see our other publications, you can check out our website, which is www.poclad.org.
And that website, I believe, also connects to this schedule if anybody
right.
missed that. So,
right.
So we still have 2 minutes left. So do you feel hopeful that we can turn this whole thing around and get back control of our country?
I do. And, in fact, that's what really attracted me to work with POCLAD, because having spent so much time beating my head against the wall as an activist, it is energizing, and it fills one with hope to understand that there's a reason why we're not getting any place. And, in fact, this whole idea of democracy and how it should work has an enormous power to it. And when you begin to realize that we don't have a democracy for very certain reasons that were set up at the beginning, and if we had democratic power truly in this country, what a different world this would be. It's a very long fight. But I find it, and a lot of the people that I've talked with about this find it hopeful. They think that, this makes sense. This makes so much sense that there's something to it.
Yeah, I agree. It's hopeful, too. And I think one of the things that's stimulating it is this interest in the World Trade Organization and world trade issues, because that has raised the issue of democracy. People realize there's a few guys up there who are making decisions that are affecting whole economies, whole continents. And that started more thinking about democracy and brought people to applying it to our own activism at a more local level, asking questions like, why can't I control what happens within a half a mile of my house, much less what the World Trade Organization does? So I'm also really encouraged by this focus, and looking forward to hearing from a lot of people in Seattle about it.
And thank you, Seattle, for the role that activists played here in getting people to notice things like the WTO.
Very good. Well, with
here.
We are unfortunately out of time, so I want to thank you both for coming in. been talking this morning with Mike Ferner and Jane Ann Morris, who are with POCLAD, the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And again, they are going to be speaking at numerous engagements in town starting tomorrow evening with tomorrow afternoon with a book signing at LA Bay Books at 1 p.m.